Welcome to Emerging Tech Mastery, a show that demystifies cutting-edge technology like cryptocurrency, the blockchain, metaverse, NFTs, virtual reality, the maker movement, artificial intelligence, machine learning, cloud, edge, and even fog computing. Strap in as we ride into the fourth industrial revolution. Emerging Tech Mastery provides actionable knowledge, regardless of skill level, from experts in the trenches. We piece together this intel in easy-to-consume media formats, processes, and procedures. See you in the future.
Thank you for coming on another episode of Emerging Tech Mastery. I am Aaron Mungle, and I'm here with Frank Trezza. He is an info security expert, and he has come on the show before, and I wanted to bring him back to talk about a couple things. Frank, first off, thanks for jumping back on.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I know you had told us a little bit about your background last time, but really quick for some new people, why don't you just quickly tell us a little bit about your background and how you got to where you are today?
Sure. I'm a certified ethical hacker. I've spent a large portion of my life behind a computer, probably more than most people. I'm very good with computer security related tasks. Some people would call me a hacker, but I generally don't call myself that. I am very knowledgeable in information security, and it's also called cybersecurity by some people. I know how to break into systems like any hacker does, but I try to use my powers for good, kind of like Uncle Ben told Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility. Or was it the other way around? I forgot.
You did tell us a little bit about ethical hacking last time, and you did, if I'm not mistaken, broke it down into offensive versus defensive. Maybe really quick, could you refresh our memory of the differences between the two? And if I'm not mistaken, both of those would be considered ethical hacking, quote unquote, right?
Yep. They all fall under that umbrella when you're doing them professionally. I'm currently what's called a purple team specialist. I work as a senior security engineer for a Fortune 500 company. And when it comes to the breakdowns of the three main types of, I guess we'd call them branches of InfoSec, we have offensive security, defensive security, and then one that's kind of a mix between the two. That's the purple teaming. When people say red team, they're referring to usually offensive. But that term is a bit of a misnomer, because in our industry, red teamers are actually people who do actual adversary emulation, where they have a very broad scope of what they're allowed to do. Whereas most people, when they think of that field, they actually are referring to something called penetration testing, which is where a company gives you a scope. They say you're allowed to hack us, but within these parameters, you have to follow these rules. And also in terms of defensive security, that would be somebody who works in maybe a security operations center, defends against attackers, whether it be that they're just monitoring and reporting or doing managed detection and response, or they actually intervene if there's a hacker. There's different whole levels of that. But in general, InfoSec kind of falls, in my opinion anyway, into three categories. You have the offensive, the defensive, and the ones that are kind of a mix between red team and purple. Red, blue, and purple are the colors associated there.
You have the colors sort of denoting, I mean, almost like we're playing a game or something, right?
Yeah, that's where it comes from. It's from military jargon.
Yeah, so you were saying most people are either red or blue, not often the hybrid purple. Is that because of just sort of the industry leans towards one or the other, or perhaps people, maybe there's more work in a certain one or the other? I've heard some people talking about it, but I'm not sure why people might go into one side or the other, right? Or both, as you pointed out.
Yeah, generally a lot of the schools, they teach a lot of the blue team stuff, how to defend a network, how to understand the very basics of networking when you start, and then moving more into more advanced cybersecurity stuff. But generally the schools are not going to be teaching offensive skills unless you go to a specific school that caters to that, or you go for a certification that's specializing in that. I think there are a lot more jobs right now for blue teamers in security operations centers and MSSPs, that's managed security service providers, with kind of place where companies outsource their security to. So that's a big field. In terms of offensive security, there are a lot fewer jobs and a lot fewer people who are really good at it. There's a lot of people who claim to be good at it, mind you. But there are very few people, in my opinion, who are actually very good at it. That's kind of where we are right now. And in terms of purple teaming, your question there, a lot of people who are really good red teamers did start out as blue teamers. And even some of the experts in the industry, like David Kennedy, recommend that you get your feet wet in a sock first and learn what an attack looks like from the perspective of the person who's going to be doing the monitoring, so that when you're actually doing the attacking, you know what to avoid so that you don't get caught. Because while it might be very easy to break into a company if they have very lax security, you might still get caught if you're, I'm talking in a professional capacity, not as a bad guy. But when you're doing a pen test, you don't want to get caught right away. You want to wait until at least towards the end and then give them a chance to catch you. But if you get burned right away, you're not going to have a really good report if they've already locked out the IP you're doing your attack infrastructure from. And you're not going to have a good day. It's going to be a bad report. So you want to learn some of the tools and techniques associated with obfuscating who you are, where you're coming from, what it looks like you're doing, things like that.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you're kind of breaking it down a little bit. Now, it might make sense to zoom out a little bit and point out, like you were talking about the system side, but you had mentioned a gentleman, Devian Alam, who's super interesting guy and really great knowledge. He basically, and I think you mentioned this last time, specializes in the physical security, or I can't remember the exact term you used, but is that pretty common that you sort of start from the bottom up? It's sort of like, and again, this is just my takeaway as a sort of non-industry professional, that it's actually non-computer and tech to start. So maybe could you walk us through sort of like the levels? Like maybe you start with the sort of physical level and then the systems, it surprised me that they're not actually the first thing you might start with. Obviously depends on the situation, I'm sure. But yeah, you have any insights there?
Sure. When it comes to people like Deviant, they're doing physical security, like you said, or FISEC is the kind of shorthand term for that. Deviant is very well-versed in lockpicking and bypassing access control systems and all sorts of fun and interesting ways to get into buildings, as well as other locks and things that protect stuff. He is probably one of the best in that industry. Him and I don't actually get along. We've got issues personally, but I still respect his work greatly. In terms of your second question there, not every hacker knows physical security stuff. Not everybody who's an InfoSec who works as a red teamer also knows how to break into a building. There are a lot of specializations in this industry where you have people who are maybe just focused on web apps, who are really good with a program like Burp Suite, and that's what they specialize in. And when you're putting together a pen test, sometimes you're just going to have one pen tester, but sometimes you're going to have a team. And if you have a team, it's usually good to have somebody who's really good at certain things. Like, for instance, what I said there, the guy who's a web app specialist is only going to be specializing in how to do web apps. They're not going to be looking at other ports besides ADN 443. They're just going to be looking at how they can break into an application like that. Whereas when it comes to physical security, there's a lot of crossover in our industry because it's a similar mindset to be curious and kind of understand how a puzzle works. And lockpicking goes back a long time. And a lot of people who are into what's called lock sport also are into hacking because it attracts a very similar kind of person. Remember when I was out in New York and part of open organization of lockpickers out there, that a lot of people who did come to the lockpicking meetups were also very much into InfoSec. It's just kind of a weird crossover that has developed over the years. And also they go to all the conferences for computer security as well. So you'll generally see a tool table where they're teaching introductory lockpicking to people who are interested. So that's why that kind of is the way that it is. But not everybody has both skill sets. In fact, I'd argue most people who are in defense in terms of blue teaming don't know lockpicking at all. It's not something that generally would attract that kind of person, but sometimes it does. More often than not, you're going to see people who are interested in offensive security, breaking into computers and such, also knowing how to do physical security. But that's not always the case also.
So would you say, that's very interesting, by the way. I guess I might have assumed that it was somewhat of a sort of foundational piece of knowledge, but I guess not. And I mean, his knowledge is so important just for like personal security. You know, he talks about locks and doors and a door being set up properly. And I'm sitting here thinking, geez, I just got a little bit of a general contractor set of knowledge.
As he as he says, a lock is really just a delay mechanism. It'll keep somebody out for an amount of time, but don't count on your life on it. Keeping honest people honest. That's one of the initial tool bylaws is you don't, I wouldn't call them bylaws, but one of the rules of being a member of Tool is you only pick a lock that you own. You don't pick a lock unless you've got the permission of the actual owner. Not even somebody who rents an apartment, you shouldn't be picking their lock for them if they get locked out. You should only be practicing on your own locks, or you're at a meetup and there's a couple of locks on the table and you're practicing those. You shouldn't be trying to help your friends get into their stuff if they're locked out unless they actually own it.
Yeah.
And even when it comes to physical penetration testing, you have to follow the rules and the scope of your engagement. There was an issue in a courthouse not long ago where two penetration testers ended up in jail because they went beyond the scope. They weren't supposed to go upstairs, but once they were in the building, they went upstairs and tripped the alarm. Ended up, sheriff came. Sheriff was unaware there was a pen test going on, and next thing you knew, it took quite a bit of elbow grease to get them out of jail. You got to follow the rules, even when you're doing stuff legally. Yeah, when it comes to pen testing banks, I think Jason Street probably has the best story about that, where he walked into the wrong bank and walked out with a computer. And then he wasn't even in America. It was in a South American country and had to go through a translator and fix the whole thing. But I believe the takeaway there was he was such a smooth operator, they hired his company to do pen tests for the bank that he accidentally robbed. Highly recommend you check out that talk. He gives it quite often. It's one of his more frequent stories he tells, but he tells it very well. So.
Wow. Yeah. Very interesting. I do like that there's like some very important principles here, frankly. It's almost like reminding me of like sort of gun ownership or something, where people have a certain, you know, certainly there's fear out there about that. But I would argue the vast majority of gun owners take it super seriously that they operate their gun properly. And I suppose this is no different. I mean, entering a space you're maybe not supposed to be in is quite a responsibility. And I think you alluded to that earlier.
It's a very stressful situation to be in. And that's why pretexting is a thing. You should come up with a very good pretext as to why you are where you are and what you're doing, and keep it as close to your real identity as possible. If you're really good with computers and you're going to be doing a pen test, maybe adopting the persona of an IT guy could be a good way to go, but then be prepared to fix somebody's computer if you have to, because you're going to get called out if you don't have the knowledge you claim to.
Right. And that's a great point. Again, I keep referring to these talks I've heard, but I've heard mention of, oh, the client said this, the client said that. Hey, is it okay if we push it further? Yeah, the client said, go ahead. So there sort of sounded like there was a very close communication with the client, and they probably would have said, no, don't go upstairs. So that sounds like a very important part, more as sort of a practitioner that was contracted, right? You got to kind of follow what you were provided. And imagine stuff like banks, right? Like, it could get real serious real quick. You could have maybe a gun drawn on you, or it could get real, frankly, dangerous, right?
It's all about the confidence. That's why people used to be called con men, who dealt in very similar roles in society, where it was all about the fact that they looked like they belonged there and they acted the appropriate way. And people just assume if somebody's got that confidence, you should follow them. If you read a book that Chris Hadnagy put out called Human Hacker, he goes a lot more into that. It's a very good recommendation of a book for people to read who are interested in that.
You know, all those stories from people doing these different teamings, we'll say, are just super intense. Like, I don't know, like, even if I was super knowledgeable in the sort of tech stuff, I don't know that I could stomach the intensity of pretty much like social engineering people and situations and whatever they got to do. I mean, I find myself almost like having a visceral reaction to imagining being that person trying to get in, you know? It's kind of fascinating that you can shape this to your personal preferences. So that's a really good point, is that, you know, it's kind of like there was this game called Deus Ex from like the late 90s, early 2000s, where you could go in a building. I mean, almost like maybe someone who made that game might have been in the business, but you could hack the keypad. You could kick the door down. You could climb on the roof and try to get in the top vent, or you could, you know, do all these other kind of crazy things. It was sort of a game of, it was like a first person shooter style game, but it had that role playing aspect of like picking different paths. And that's kind of what I felt from you, is kind of like, you can pick a different way. Many ways to do it.
And that being said, even though the social engineering is a very good way to get the information that you need, it's not the only way. Everybody's got different skill sets. Some people are good at speaking. Some people are just good at the computer. They're good at hacking. They don't want to deal with people. They don't want to even give the final report after they've done an assessment. That's the worst part of it for them. I'm friends with a bunch of people who are just highly autistic, very socially awkward, but amazing hackers, but don't want to even deal with talking to the client if they can all at all avoid it. There's more than one way to get the information you're going to be after. If you're doing a penetration test as a pen tester, you have to follow the scope. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. If they say that, like, vishing, calling up the client and pretending to be somebody else, if they say that's out of scope, you don't do that. Because if you do, and you even if you get the information, you've invalidated the scope of the work, and the whole test is gone. You've essentially cheated. It's like getting caught cheating on an exam in high school. The client may be okay with it, but more oftentimes they're not. And you really do need to read your document, your scope of work, when you're doing a pen test, and make sure that you got your get out of jail free card, so to speak, where the client has signed it. You've had your employer or your legal counsel, if you're doing it yourself, draft something and signed it, and all your bases are covered, because otherwise you can get in a lot of trouble doing this. So it's good to be careful. But in terms of Deus Ex and the different attack paths, if you're an attacker and everything is in scope, like in a red team exercise, which is actual threat emulation where you can do everything a bad guy can do, including phishing, vishing, whaling, all those kind of things where you can cater attacks towards specific people. If you're going to do that, then you got to get your story straight ahead of time and have your attack infrastructure set up beforehand. So that you're going to be sending somebody a fish, you better have a domain set up that can catch the click, so that if they click the link, it's got to go somewhere, right? So you have to already have set up that web server. You have to already have a believable looking login page if you're trying to capture credentials, or if you're trying to do session hijacking, that you've already set up Evil Jinx or something like that to be able to ride in on a session cookie, as they call it, where once they click the link and you get their credentials, their in whatever format they may be in this case, they might be hashed, whatever, that you're able to then use that information as quickly as possible to get to where you want to go. So it's a lot of planning and figuring out ahead of time what you're going to do, and also having contingency plans for when things go wrong. You have to have a plan A, a plan B, and also all the way up to a plan Z sometimes. If you look at a thing called the pen test execution standard, it really breaks down the different pre-engagement activities, as they're called there, where you have to get the documents signed properly. You have to make sure everybody's on board with what's going to be done right. Those are all things you do before you even start. And you have to define what IP addresses are going to be in scope. If there's going to be users that you're going to fish, which users are allowed, which ones are not. And a lot of work goes into that before even doing your open source intelligence and looking into it. You got to plan. A lot of planning goes into it. And going back, one more thing I wanted to say about the Deus Ex, the multiple ways of doing the same thing. When it comes to red teaming, those tend to be very long engagements where they have a lot more time than a typical pen test to try and get in and try different stuff. But sometimes they're over way quicker than a pen test, because all they have to do is pick up the phone, call somebody, and convince them to do something stupid. And before it, they've already gotten everything they need. Because as even Kevin Mitnick says, the human element is the weak point in security. You can spend millions of dollars on all these systems and all these different products to keep your network safe, but all it takes is Becky and accounting to click that PDF you sent her and open it up, and now you've got access to that computer. And from there, you can kind of move around the network and go for lateral access. So it can be very quick or very, very hard, depending on what's allowed, and also the skill sets involved of the people on the team.
Yeah, and they might not even know what happened. That's the craziest part, right? They're like, oh, weird. It was a blank document. Huh, okay, close. And then, as what you just said, continues on. So it is a very interesting situation with that. So I'm curious about the authorities in the industry, and you've already threw out a few names, and I had also thrown out, you know, you've got like these different organizations, and I am curious, you know, you got like SANS, who does education, NIST, who does standards, and then CISA. I've been to ISSA events. You have OWASP, of course. Yeah. Like, if you could maybe, would you consider those somewhat authorities or sort of like body, we'll say community bodies, and also are there any others that you would consider, quote, authorities in this space?
Yeah, I toss like OWASP in there, Open Web Application Standards Project, and most of the ones you mentioned, they put out standards in more of the GRC, governmental, regulatory, and compliance world. Even if you are just doing pen testing, you are probably going to need to know some of the ISO standards that fall under NIST, like ISO 27001, the NIST cybersecurity framework, or any of those. just being familiar with them is helpful. So how the defenders work, as well as MITRE, M-I-T-R-E, puts out the attack and defend framework, where it's a different way of categorizing attacks and defensive techniques against them. And they have a really nice visual kind of thing. If you go on their GitHub, where you can kind of mouse over and it'll show, if you hover over initial access, it will show the different types of attacks that are commonly used for initial access. And they have even a breakdown numerically, assigning different techniques to different numerical codes. If you were to look in the DSM-4 for psychiatry, or 5 now, you would have this mental disorder is that code. It's the same thing with this. This attack is that number. And then you also have things where you have attack simulation, where there are products out there that will essentially run Python scripts that will emulate an attacker but not do nastiness. I think Attack IQ puts out one of those. And then there's the atomic testing frameworks, where you can essentially run neutered versions of the attacks to see how your defense is. And there's also different standards bodies and all that kind of stuff out there. There's different certification authorities as well. I'm a big fan of offensive security in terms of penetration testing certification, as well as Hack the Box has their own certificate now that's almost comparable to it. I'd say it's a little easier than the OSCP exam, but not, they give you more time for it. So if you're not good at doing things within a short amount of time, that would be a better exam to go for. The one that they put out, I think it's a certified pen tester or something like that, they call it. There's so many different certifying bodies out there and people claiming that they're the authorities on what is the best. And it's really hard to know. A lot of people also consider EC Council, who puts out Certified Ethical Hacker Exam, not to be very reputable. They even have an entry on attrition.org's charlatan website, InfoSec Charlatans, because they've in the past done things that are not quite as ethical as people would like. Despite that, I'm still a certified ethical hacker, and hopefully will be if they ever hear this podcast and decide that they're now mad at me for saying that. But yeah, there's lots of bodies out there to do certification and are considered authorities in terms of companies too. I tend to know the ones that contribute to the open source community because I use their tools. So I'm familiar with the names of their companies, like Binary Defense Systems and TrustedSec from David Kennedy. And then there's John Strand, who gives out free trainings and contributes open source tools. And he works for, I think, Black Hills. And there's just tons of companies that give back to the community. And those tend to be the ones that I'm personally familiar with. But there are others as well who I'm sure are doing just as good work.
So let's jump into, there's this, you know, there's always new hacks and cracks and breaks and breaches, right? But laws are pretty interesting and maybe a little crazy. So I wanted to touch on, what's the Restrict Act and why is it concerning to the industry?
That's a great question. The Restrict Act was kind of initially a response to the whole let's ban TikTok because of various reasons. And it has since grown to be a very over-encompassing bill that has a lot of stuff in there that doesn't belong in there. I've heard different schools of thought on this. I've heard from some friends of mine who are more based than others that the people who put together the bill want it to fail because they want TikTok to stay around. So they put all this stuff in there that they know would drive people crazy who are in the industry so that they would rally against getting it passed. I've heard different sides to the whole thing, but the gist of the Restrict Act is they're even going to make VPNs technically illegal if you're using them to access TikTok, if they banned TikTok. And then they were going to, there's just so much stuff in there that doesn't belong in there. They're going to set up a standards body within the government that the president at the time would get to pick somebody to lead it. And these would be non-elected officials who are then going to be in charge of essentially the nation's cybersecurity laws, and have a lot of power to do things that really shouldn't be in the hands of people who don't either understand the technology or haven't at least been elected, in my opinion, and then confer with the experts, because it's just overreaching, really overreaching, and what they're saying that they'll have the access to do, what would be illegal, and the rights they're giving themselves. People want to trade a little bit of their security a little bit of their freedom for security, and that's just never a good idea. We want to be protected from threats from China, whether it be influence operations where they're trying to influence our youth to do stupid things that might destabilize our economy or convince people to act in ways that might not be in their best interest, versus there are cases of actual Chinese applications on Android devices that have have been used maliciously, where they've, whether it be gathering more data than they're saying that they're gathering, or not even securing that data properly, or going way further than that and actually like pushing malicious updates to apps on behalf of the CCP so that they can then have access to somebody's phone that they know is going to be connected to a certain Wi-Fi network and try and pivot from the phone into that network. There's just scary stuff that can be done. And we dealt with it years ago with the Hikvision cameras, where they flooded our markets with cheap IP cameras and governments bought them and put them in government buildings. And then they were using a backdoor in those cameras to try and hack into those networks. It's scary stuff. And you happens with IP phones too. And you gotta know what's in the products. You use a lot harder with embedded systems and phones. So that's a whole nother branch of security with IoT and SCADA and Internet of Things devices. But the gist of the bill from what I was trying to say before I got derailed myself there is that they're trying to give themselves too much authority to be able to do the thing they're claiming they want to do. And a lot of people in the community are very upset that they are claiming they need all these rights and abilities and laws to do a very simple thing, which is ban that app from the App Store. Tell Google and Apple, you can't have it, take it off, and block access to the website somehow. DNS sinkhole from America or whatever they want to do. They're overreaching, is my opinion. And I'm sure you'll find other opinions that are even better informed than me. But that's my take on it.
No, I appreciate you sharing a little bit more about it. And that was pretty much the, for the most part, what I had heard as well. One question I had, and you know, this is something good. The Electronic Frontier Foundation is a pretty awesome organization as far as weighing in on these type of situations. Cause I found them and I was thinking, cool, I've heard of them. I know they've done great work over the years, but I just wanted to point that out if anyone's, you know, listening and wants to know, frankly, that's a great source. Like I would just go directly to them if there's any bill like this or in the future. And I just wanted to see, is there anything before this? Cause I should have probably done a little more research here, but there was something that took place. I'm trying to think exactly when, whether it was like 2010s or early 2000s, where they tried to do some other thing that got people riled up. I think it might have been some kind of data. It was like maybe privacy, or there was sort of like.
It was probably their attempt to put backdoors in the encryption and claim that the government should have a copy of the master keys. That was a big deal not too long ago. There's also things with net neutrality that really pissed some people off that the government.
Yeah. So the net neutrality, backdoors for sure. I mean, they want to make it crackable. The net neutrality thing, what was that? I guess what I'm trying to do is kind of weigh these situations.
Oh yeah. In a nutshell, the whole net neutrality argument was that everybody should have the same kind of access to the internet. If you're paying for it, they shouldn't be able to nickel and dime you for the access that you're getting. It should be similar to a public utility. You pay for your internet access and you can use it and it just works. And you shouldn't have corporations being able to pay to get faster access where their materials would be served up preferably to other people's, and having a slow lane and a fast lane, and the poor people would get the slow lane and the rich people and the corporations get the fast lane. Also, it goes into T-Mobile and all those companies nickel and diming people for data that doesn't really cost them anything, claiming that they're going to reinvest in infrastructure and then instead taking the money and passing them along to their shareholders.
Yeah. And, you know, not to be like taking pot shots at the telecom industry, but I've thought about that many times myself. I'm like, seriously, guys, like how many times over has this infrastructure been paid for? And I understand investing in new, but like you said, it's ends up being a little bit of lip service, and they're just, you know, I mean, the margins must be ridiculous at this point because it's paid for. And they're going to continue to sort of keep this artificially high price relative to the actual cost. But yeah, that should definitely be another thread on telecom. Cause again, that's pretty much a vulnerability, not to open up a total rabbit hole, but from what I understand about SMS, it's actually insane. Like I hear never do two-factor authentication on SMS because it's frankly vulnerable and weak. Again.
Yeah, Lucky 25 actually put out a really good article on Medium about that. You should check out.
Okay. Yep. I'm going to put that in the show notes. But really quick, back to kind of what you said. I mean, would you say the Restrict Act has a little bit of a more, I don't want to say like more bad. I mean, everything seems kind of like it would have negative effects. And
In my opinion, if they passed it as is, it could lead to the Great Firewall of America. Kind of, they have the Great Firewall of China. And it's kind of ironic because the bill is designed to address issues with CCP and using influence operations. But for our response to be, let's do the same thing they're doing and wall off our internet from the rest of the world to a degree, is not probably the best.
Like you said, overreaching, heavy-handed, and it is changing the nature of the government's sort of role. I think what you had said about the net neutrality comment was there's a little bit of a sort of community, even in an international level. I had seen a video about what takes place with ICANN and how they do some kind of signing of the root of the internet. I don't even really understand what that all entails, but
root certificate authority stuff. There's lots of interesting stuff with ICANN and the racket they got going there with the domain names and stuff. But yeah, I think that in my opinion, if you're going to pay the money to register a domain, it should be a one-time thing and then it's yours. You shouldn't have to renew it every year and then have to deal with, if you forget to renew, somebody else can steal it from you. And it's a racket, but it's something that doesn't cost them money to keep in their records, but then they keep charging you to update every year because they can. And there's alternatives to that kind of DNS out there where you can put a browser plugin extension and then you go to these weird domains with words instead of .com or .net, they have .crypto or whatever. And you can go to these weird domains if you have that extension. And then they never expire. But who's going to install a browser extension to go to a domain, right? For now, they're safe when they're racket where they can charge us over and over again for a domain. And yeah.
No, I love that you mentioned the Web3 thing because I get a little grumpy about Web3 being used on every single tech that's new when we are actually talking about domains here. So the people that are selling domains in this new context, I think actually can claim to be Web3. But everyone wants to be Web3, but yeah, like you said, it's a one-time fee rather than, you know, geez, when you, as you're talking, and I've thought this thought before, it's like we're in like trailer parks or something, and it's like you don't own it, you're renting forever. Man, it's like Klaus Schwab's vision's already realized there, but yeah, I think this Web3 evolution hopefully will change that, but you made a good point. You know, how long is it going to take for a domain used by the masses to enable those sites? I do think it's coming, but I think you bring up a good point of, you know, it's not right now and it's not everyone. So maybe a little bit of a, you know, early adopters there. Yeah. So I wanted to talk a little bit about, there were some recent hacks that lightly, maybe more than lightly, terrified me. And you know, again, let me know if you kind of know about each one. If not, it's cool. We'll link to some articles, but the first one was the Pixel phones. Someone was able to remotely hack in, and if I'm not mistaken, they didn't even really, like, I don't fully understand how they did it, but it's like no one did anything wrong and people could get in, if I understand what they were saying. So you had brought something up in a different answer you gave, and I didn't want to go too deep in that rabbit hole, but this is probably a good chance to circle back to that, which was you mentioned those cameras that were put in to government facilities and stuff that had these exploits. And it kind of got me thinking, and I know this is a broad question, so I understand if you can't give the, you know, perfect answer for it, but is it these exploits, are they typically like software or application based, or is there ever, like, to use your point, firmware, hardware? I mean, hardware, again, it seems like they would have to like physically maybe do something. But what I'm hearing is there could be sort of hardware exploits because, again, the devil's in the details, right? So you have these like little nuances that people figure out and are able to do a bunch of stuff before it's patched or whatever the term is to fix it. So what's your take there on sort of applications, software versus sort of hardware being the exploit, if you will?
Yeah, I believe you only really needed to have somebody's cell phone number to get that attack to work if you had the exploit. And also, it wasn't just limited to Pixel phones. It was Samsung phones as well, if memory serves. It was Project Zero. That's Google's bug bounty team that figured that out. And it has to do with the modem, the cellular modem in the phone. It's its own little subsystem in your phone. And it's your phone, as you look at your cell phone, you got your touch screen and you got the internals of your phone, and within there's a chip, and that chip itself is responsible for the communications on the LTE network. And that chip itself had a vulnerability that could be exploited. I don't know if it was a buffer overflow or whatnot. It's been a while since I read about this, but the gist of it was there was this modem, I think it was called Exynos or something like that. And the modem that is used in multiple phones was vulnerable. It wasn't just Pixel phones. It was the S22 from Samsung and a bunch of other ones. I think even the A53, which is the phone I had until a few months ago, was vulnerable to it. And Pixel 6 and 7. Yeah, it was a big deal. I think it was early March that it happened, if memory serves. And the fix, at least the temporary fix, was to disable VoLTE and Wi-Fi calling until they figured out and updated it with a new patch to the operating system that could then flash new firmware to that chip so that it would no longer be vulnerable. Firmware is like software for embedded devices. They would update a new version of the operating system onto that chip so that it would no longer have that issue.
That's some deep stuff, man. I feel like this is such an intense, like, sort of, there's a lot of nuance here because, you know, I mean, that's actually kind of brilliant. Like, it was sort of like a Trojan horse, so to speak, you know, maybe not in a malicious sense, but in a sort of granting access sense, which I guess is technically malicious. It seems like just some huge, what's the word I'm looking for? Oversights, just like massive oversights. Like, I think about all of that equipment being brought, and I mean, I kind of want to ask the scary question, which is like, has it all been discovered and removed? I can't imagine so from what the little I know about corporate IT, like systems sit in the shadows for a long time. So what you're bringing up kind of makes me wonder, did they rip everything out yet? Or, you know, are there some devices that are still like maybe overlooked still?
That's a combination. Sometimes they intentionally put backdoors in software and hardware. More often than not, though, you have just lazy programming being the fault, where you have a developer who didn't maybe check an input field somewhere, enable the buffer overflow to happen because maybe they said, this is going to be a character field that's only going to have 128 characters that can go in here or whatever. And then somebody puts 129 and now you're in adjacent memory space and you can start executing code. Input validation is a very big issue that just... When you get to the kind of programming languages that you're using for embedded devices like C and C++, there's a lot of room for error with programmers who aren't necessarily checking all the things that they should, that some of the more modern languages, say Rust, would help you with at least and let you know this is a bad idea to code things this way. It's a combination. Like I said, sometimes you have these bad guys who intentionally are doing things that they shouldn't, putting a backdoor in a piece of software that's shipped from the factory that way, or even piece of hardware. They suspected that Huawei, who makes those, I don't ever say that word right, but that's the name of the company, Huawei, I believe. They made really cheap phones that you could get at Walmart for $30, and they also had some high-end ones. They're not even allowed to use the official Android software anymore, because they're putting backdoors in their phones and also in their telecom equipment that our government bought and then put in the backbones of our internet, the connection points between large cities and whatnot, where you have to have these very expensive switches and routers that need to be able to handle very large amounts of traffic. And they go to lowest bidder, and lowest bidder happened to be Huawei, and China knew at a time, you're like, hey, it's going to be a good opportunity for us to get access to their critical infrastructure. They backdoored it. And at least that's my opinion, that they did it intentionally and it wasn't necessarily an overlooked thing on their part. But it does really vary. The big thing we have to worry about nowadays is supply chain attacks, where a company that maybe makes software themselves gets compromised and they have an update mechanism. And then when the software updates, it pulls down a malicious version. Or even software that takes advantage of other software and they don't tell you that it's running that. Log4j was a big one recently. A lot of companies were running it and didn't even know it. It was the logging mechanism that's built into Java natively. A lot of applications took advantage of that, but there was a vulnerability in it, meaning almost every application written in Java, companies buy stuff, they don't know what programming language it's written in. If it's web-facing, it could get exploited. Even if it's not, just getting something into the logs could then exploit the vulnerability. There were lots of issues fixing that, and it's a scary world out there, and that's why I think their most recent recommendation from CISA was to get what's called the SBOM, a Software Bill of Materials, first, so that you know what your software actually has in it. If it's relying on third-party libraries, if it's relying on another piece of software, some kind of open-source software, that you know exactly what's in your infrastructure. Yeah, there's a lot of devices that are overlooked. There's even the most popular devices out there, Cisco. Their stuff has vulnerabilities in it that hasn't been disclosed yet. There's a really brilliant researcher who's got his own company named Ong. I always say his last name wrong. I think it's Chu. He runs Red Balloon Security. I met him years ago when I was working the door at SummerCon in New York City. And they actually take Cisco devices apart and they get down to the firmware on it, and they're able to extract the actual code that's on these devices and go through it and figure out these vulnerabilities that just haven't been seen before, ways of glitching the chip when it boots up to get into it and just tell it whatever you want. And you can tell it to dump the software that's got on there. Brilliant, brilliant person. So good at hardware hacking that it makes me look like a complete novice, but it's those people are out there and they're always finding new stuff. And luckily a lot of them are on our side. They're doing responsible disclosure. They're letting the vendors know, and they're giving them time to fix the stuff before presenting it at DEF CON. But then there's also people who are not quite as ethical, who have similar skill sets in other countries, who might not be disclosing what they're finding. A lot of people like to call it stockpiling O-days, and it is a thing. There's even marketplaces out there like Zerodymium. They'll pay you $1 million if you have an iOS exploit that works. So there's a big market out there for exploit dev and hardware hackers to... No, use the Wi-Fi at DEF CON. You can get on the wall of sheep. You'll love it.
That's incredible. I'm glad you brought up the zero-day marketplace. I just recently learned about that existing, and it's sort of like, yeah, it's like a bug bounty system on steroids, right? Since it's a full-on marketplace. And it does make you wonder, you know, and it's almost like I look at people doing like graffiti on signs, and I think, man, you know, what if the city somehow engaged these people that are super creative and taking huge risks to, you know, black out that highway sign? But, you know, maybe there's a way to kind of engage. And I'm sure, you know, people have tried, and certainly DEF CON you mentioned is, you know, there's kind of these like, I don't want to say necessarily neutral territory, but we'll say sort of common territory where people gather and share knowledge and stuff. But as you pointed out, like, don't sign on to the Wi-Fi at DEF CON for anyone who's new and wants to run into this. So things like that, you probably need to do. It just begs the question of, you know, maybe we shouldn't be running into like unproven, unnamed brands, because I mean, I can only imagine just that temptation for them to just do it and, oh, sorry, later, right? I mean, what are we going to do?
Oh, it's happened recently with home routers too. A lot of the lesser known brands, like the cheap Chinese router you get at Walmart for $30, they had a software flaw, which people are still arguing whether or not it was a flaw or intentional, but allowed a remote person to get into your network. And there was no fix for it at the time that it was disclosed. So you had a bunch of, I think it was called Zynga routers out there that you could go on Shodan and just get a list of them. And you could get into any one of those networks fairly easily. There was publicly available code on ExploitDB that would get you into it. It's scary when you look at the threat profile out there. But I think there's things people can do to keep themselves safe. And as long as they're doing their best, it's very likely they're not going to run into a lot of the issues, the low-hanging fruit, which is called that other people do.
Yeah, well, I suppose that might be a good chance to jump into that. Unless, did you have any thoughts on the e-file one? I wasn't sure if you had seen the details on that yet.
Yeah, that was actually the IRS's site, but it was a third party, kind of similar to TurboTax, right? They were relying on the sense of urgency, because I think the filing date right now at the time of this cast is maybe 6 or 7 days away. When you have to file, otherwise you're going to get penalties. They're taking advantage of that sense of urgency, and they compromised one of those third-party websites that the IRS actually recommends you use to file your taxes. Not necessarily the IRS's site itself, though. And they were able to put some malicious JavaScript in the web page that recorded the information that was being passed along when you went to go do your e-file. That would be all that information that's in your tax return, and there's definitely some juicy stuff for bad people in there. Very similar to the Mage Cart attack that was going around not long ago, where they would compromise the shopping carts on websites, and when people would put their credit cards in, they would get them as well.
Yeah, see, that's where I get like, oh man, I mean, you kind of have to, you know, again, you could have used a different site, but, you know, I think a lot of people feel compelled to use those sites or services. And so that's where, yeah, that's a pretty brutal one. And yeah, I mean, I guess it kind of brings up really quick, like, how vulnerable browsers are. I mean, when I start really digesting like how insane vulnerabilities on browsers are, it's like you almost don't even want to use a browser. And I'm almost surprised there isn't a, you know, Fort Knox of browser brand yet, because I'd probably use that even if it was slow, because it's really scary out there with all the just plumbing going on the web. Even I've heard through ads, like display ads and banners, there can be this kind of funky stuff going on.
That's called malvertising.
Really?
The whole industry, actually. Yeah, there are these people, and they are able to essentially sneak stuff into ads that are on websites. They're even sneaking crypto miners into some of the ads at some point, where essentially as long as you're on that page, it would be using your resources to mine them crypto. There's lots of bad stuff out there. Fortunately, there are browsers that are a bit more secure out of the box than your default Chrome or Firefox install. I think Brave does a really good job of hardening the default issues that you're going to see in Chrome-based browsers, because they're still Chrome-based, so it's Chromium under the hood, but they've taken the steps of at least changing some of the flags and securing some of the common issues that you might run into if you're just using an out-of-the-box browser as it would come when you install it first on a new computer. New computer, rather.
Good to hear about Chromium, because I have to use that for Zencastr, which I'm using to record. But yeah, I mean, really quick on the banners and stuff, is that something where you don't even have to click to get sort of it can get access to you, or do you have to actually click on the ad to activate that code?
It can be either or. Generally, there's some good things, some good plugins you can run in Chrome or any browser. uBlock Origin has a really good block list of blocking the malicious ad servers, and you can even run NoScript, which is a thing that'll completely disable JavaScript unless you explicitly tell it to run it. In general, if you want to stay safe, your best bet is just not do stupid stuff. Yeah.
Right, exactly. Because to your point, I mean, like Brave, you mentioned Brave, and if I'm not mistaken, they have like sort of a toggle on or off. So if you toggle something off and then do something stupid, you know, what good are these guardrails if, you know, you're going to just move the guardrail and go over the cliff, right? So why don't we go into that low-hanging fruit you were starting to get into about ways to protect ourselves? And I know last time, just to kind of recap, you did mention things like really good passwords and a firewall and a VPN. But yeah, I don't know if you want to rehash some of that or if you have any other sort of robust solutions to share that are sort of low-hanging fruit, if you will.
Yeah, and generally, you want to make sure your computer is running some kind of antivirus software besides Defender. Defender's actually gotten a lot better in recent years than it used to be. It used to be kind of a joke, but I'm not going to recommend any specific brands, but do your research and look who Gartner recommends or whoever you trust. You want AV on your box, and you also want a password manager, probably not LastPass nowadays, but you want some kind of LastPass solution like NordPass or OnePass or any one of the popular ones, or even I think KeePass is completely free. Open source, but then you have to spend more time configuring it and getting it to work right and worrying about syncing it across devices and whatnot, but worth the time to set up if you're going to do it properly. The password manager, antivirus, making sure your firewall's on your computer, running a scan once in a while for malware on your computer as well. Malwarebytes makes a great product for removing malware that a lot of techies still use. You use the trial and then uninstall it. And then if you're a good person, you pay for it and don't just reinstall it again and keep using it over and over again and reinstalling the trial. But there's lots of solutions out there that will take care of AV stuff. And let's see, a FIDO compliant kind of key like a YubiKey would be a great start for many people. Or when you log into a site online, once you've configured this, you also maybe have to plug this device in addition to typing your password and then touch it. And then when you do that, then it lets you into the site. They're not really that hard to configure, and they're less than $70, I think. Those are all some really good starting steps. Also, making sure you're not using the same password on multiple sites. I think LastPass had a tool that would let you know if you were doing that, but there are other ones built into other password managers as well that will be like, hey, you're using that same password of summer 2023 on all these websites. That's a bad idea. If one of them gets breached, they're going to know your password to use in other websites. You want to also enable that two-factor authentication. So even if they get your password, they then still have to enter a code from an authenticator app or a YubiKey. Something you have, something you are, something you hold, I think is how it goes. I could get that wrong. But gist of it is, the more factors you have behind you, the less likelihood somebody's going to get into your stuff. But even when companies take all those precautions, there are things like browser in the browser attacks where somebody gets a link, they click it, it looks like their company's portal. Even looks like if you go up to the top and you look in there, say HTTPS, it'll even have the right stuff in there. But it's actually a fake browser window designed to look like the real one. It looks like your version of Chrome or Firefox or whatnot, and it looks like the legitimate website. People put their credentials in. And when they click the yes on their authenticator app, the bad guys are able to capture what's called a session token, which is essentially the version of your authentication that's going across the wire there. That's your identifier for that site or that service that's saying, yes, I am that person. They then get a copy of that, they put it on their own computer, and they have whatever level of access you do to those systems, at least for the amount of time. That's also, if you're going to be setting stuff up, you want to have things expire. You log into your bank account, it expires after maybe a few minutes of not browsing. That's a very good security precaution to put on your company's website as well. You want your sessions to expire, not last forever. If you log into Facebook, it's always going to be logged into that computer on Facebook. They go to the Mac store, if you're bored one day, you walk around those computers, half of them are going to be signed into people's Facebook accounts. There's stuff you can really avoid doing, like signing in to other people's devices or devices you don't control with your credentials when you don't have a second factor to re-authenticate them. If your session's not going to expire and you log into your Gmail account on a public computer, it's still going to be logged in a week from now when somebody else goes to use that computer in the library, right? You got to be cognizant of what you're doing and not make dumb mistakes. Those are some low-hanging fruit things that would be for regular people. In my industry, we use that term a little bit differently to usually mean services that companies have exposed that definitely shouldn't be. Running an old version of a WSFTP server that's got an exploit for it from 10 years ago. That's our version of low-hanging fruit. But for your regular person to reduce their attack profile, those are the low-hanging fruit things that you can definitely do to stay safer.
Yeah, good to know the lingo in case I'm, people, know what we're talking about, the same thing, right? Also, you made a good point about, and again, we always hate that moment where you got to sign in and maybe you don't have your password handy or whatever, but that sort of sign out of other devices can be also quite useful as a feature because, again, you're going to take the hit in convenience, but that's something so easy to forget, and it kind of makes you, I think that if I'm not mistaken, certain Gmails might actually do that automatically. I think certain,
it's the way you set it up. If you're running a corporate Gmail as your thing. Also, if you're running even a private account, you go into security settings and there's an area in there where you can see all the devices that are currently authenticated with your account. And you can take some off if you want to, if they're not things you're using.
This really quick, while we're on the two-factor authentication angle, I think you're familiar, you obviously know those apps and such. There was this feature on Authy, A-U-T-H-Y, and I think it's such a horrible feature. Again, it's that whole convenience, like ruining everything, right? Multiple device 2FA. It's like, sweet, here's like two options to get in, and like one device is like compromised. They could like still get in, So I don't know if you agree with that. Like from what I was told that, yeah, that double device thing is no good. And
that's a convenience versus security kind of issue. Google Authenticator does that too. If you need to move your tokens over to a new phone, and I still recommend Google Authenticator, even though you can do that because it's fairly secure. Other solutions out there, ones that cost money like Okta, they will only let you use that device. But if you get locked out or if you break the screen on your phone, you don't want to be out of work for like 3 days where you're waiting for your screen to be repaired. You got to have somebody at a company who's going to be then designated to reset multi-factor codes, and smaller companies don't really always have that. That's why sometimes it's good to have a backup way to get into your stuff, but it's not the best backup way. The best backup way would be to use the YubiKey in conjunction with your password, and then if you lose your YubiKey, you could print out a page with some codes, keep it in your safe or whatever, and then enter one of those codes to get back in until you're able to get access to your key again, or get a new key and then link that one to your stuff. Generally, hardware keys are definitely going to be safer than two-factor on a phone. But even then, there are clever hacks around that stuff too for people who know how to bypass MFA. The best solution is to do everything the right way the first time. Don't pick a dumb password. Don't use it everywhere. Don't assume that just because you have a password and you use it, the same really secure password, maybe it's a whole passphrase like correct horse battery staple, something like that. Would you think that just because you have a secure password that you can use it everywhere and nobody's ever going to figure it out? You want to assume that your password will get into the wrong hands and make sure that there's something besides your password that will block somebody from getting in that case.
Was there anything else that you wanted to touch on that I didn't ask you about?
Don't use SMS as your second factor. It's very, very vulnerable. There's things besides swim stopping attacks that are a lot easier for attackers to do to get access to your text messages. You can even set up your own little femtocell, which would be able to intercept SMS messages if somebody's near you. You don't really want to rely on those as a method for two-factor for anything. I think Coinbase learned that the hard way when a bunch of people had their accounts hacked with SMS and they had to reimburse them. You don't want to run into that same issue, so just don't use it.
Especially when it seems to be somewhat of a known fact at this point, right? It's pretty well documented and there doesn't seem to be much of a like better plan or way to have that and be secure, right? And that's where I get sort of bent out of shape about, man, you know, certain conveniences really undermine the whole thing. And I think not to start a whole new thread, but certainly with certain like KYC rules with banking and like crypto, it's like, well, the whole point is that your identity is like removed from that. But now you guys want to intermingle this whole honeypot IRS level data and combine it now with this. And so that's where, you know, it gets a little frustrating, especially when the state or feds are compelling people to do it. But like you said, forget about them for a second. Let's just do things the right way the first time. I love that. That was such a probably the biggest takeaway. Because, you know, that's something we can just keep in mind day to day, right? We have to be patient with ourselves if we're new and not super diligent. You know, you've put in tons of time.
The most impactful thing I think most everyday people can do is just spend a weekend, go through all your passwords on all these sites, and anyone that you're using in more than one place, use a random password generator and change it to something really strong and only use it on that site. And then make sure you keep all those passwords secure somewhere, hopefully like a password vault. And that's going to be impactful right away because you'd be surprised how many attacks there are out there where people will go on a site, they'll pay a couple of bucks and be able to get access to all your old passwords, and then they'll try them on all your stuff. And you don't want to fall vulnerable to that. Even for a site you may not care about now, it might be something you care about later. Just go through the list of all your sites. If you save your passwords in Chrome, that's also a horrible idea. Don't do that because all the commodity malware that's out there knows how to read those passwords. You don't want to just save them right in the browser, but you want to have some kind of password manager and change your passwords. And if you really want to do something great, go get yourself a FIDO compliant key, something like a YubiKey, or it doesn't even have to be YubiKey. You could use many other competitors to that, but that's just the one I've used. So that's what I say, but it's a really solid step anybody can take to just get a lot more secure right away. And if YubiKey hears this, I expect a royalty check for anybody who signs up because they heard it from me.
Yep, I actually, yep, that's one I've heard of as well. And yeah, it's something worth getting accustomed to, right? I think if you listen to enough of these conversations, to people like yourself and some of the great people you've mentioned, don't be surprised, everyone, if you find yourself having a keychain full of interesting fun toys, including a YubiKey. So fair warning, your pockets are going to be bulging, but you're going to be having a good old time using all these tools, hopefully, right? So,
yeah, and be careful who you show your stuff to. You don't want people to know what you're using even. Just because you have a YubiKey, you don't necessarily have to put it on your keychain. And if you do, maybe put something over it. You don't need people knowing your business.
Very good point. Very good point. Yep. People that are aware might, yeah, you're right. Put two and two together. I mean, I've seen people logging into Coinbase at coffee shops. So great point on various levels, really. Well, thanks so much for the chat. I mean, really enjoyed it. I like that we went a little deeper on some certain topics. I mean, that first chat, it just felt like, wow, there's all this like stuff here and we'll have to go back to that. So I'm glad we were able to do that here. How can we get in touch with you and you know, keep in touch?
Sure, I'm on Twitter. My handle is BustedSec, BustedSec, and I'm also, you can email me frank.treza at atlas-cybersecurity.com. Yep. Always happy to answer questions if anybody's got any.
Absolutely. And yeah, we're looking forward to, you know, future stuff you're working on. I think last time you had mentioned a security summit, and I'm really stoked to, you know, hopefully maybe participate and definitely learn. So I appreciate you sharing your knowledge. Always some great resources you're sharing, and lots of homework for people. You know, I think they probably know by now, if you're going to listen to a chat with Frank and myself, there's going to be a lot of homework, and not that you have to do it all, but you know, it'll be there when you're ready, hopefully.
Absolutely.
Thanks again, Frank. Talk to you next time.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.